For over 10 years, we've been bringing you killer metal music and frank discussions about heavy metal. Wait, who the hell is Frank? You are tuned into MSR Cast, brought to you by Mainstream Resistance. Here are your hosts, Kerry the Metal Geek and Sean the Metal Pigeon. Keep it metal.
Hi, this is James Avera. I'm going back to old school. MSR Cast? Oh, come on. Yes, we've been around for a long time, and we're not going away. This is James Avera from Hellstar. Support your local scene.
Welcome, my friend, to episode number 237 of MSR Cast, your heavy metal podcast. I am one of your hosts. I am Kerry the Metal Geek, along with
Sean the Metal Pigeon.
And we have a very special guest for a very special two-part episode. It's like one of those old 80s sitcoms that is going to be continued because it's so special and epic. Welcome, Maurice, from Blues Funeral. Thank you for coming on to the show tonight.
Thanks for having me back. Always a pleasure to hang with you guys.
So we've been wanting to do this for a long time. We've been working on a set list and talking about it for a while. We're going to feature heavy metal, keyboard heavy stuff, Mellotron, all that good stuff. Anything with a keys on it, we're going to cover on these episodes. And we want to sort of talk about what bands, in our opinion, sort of epitomize different styles. So we're going through all kinds of styles of metal here. Like you could probably guess by the first song we heard on this show, it's one of the oldest band that we've ever played on the show on this for this episode, and that's Deep Purple, Hush.
Such a good tune.
It really is.
Actually, Blues Funeral covered Hush at a local record store, Sound Exchange.
I was there. I have video of that somewhere.
Yeah. I think we posted it somewhere too, but needless to say, Blues Funeral is huge fans of Deep Purple and John Lord's work on the organ, so love the fact that we opened up with that.
So why did you pick that particular Deep Purple song?
I think it's one that, you know, especially for that classic Hammond B3 organ tone that John Lord is so well known for. I mean, you really hear it showcased very nicely in, you know, kind of the groove and the vibe that you hear in that track. Shades of Deep Purple is also a record that I feel like does not get discussed as much as, say, Burn or In Rock or Fireball or Machine Head especially. So it's nice to just kind of go back to that. I guess it was 1968, I think, when the record came out.
I think it was 68, yeah.
Yeah.
Was that their second album?
Ooh, testing my purple knowledge. Uh-oh. I mean, it's certain Purple Mach 1. I want to say it's the debut album. Yeah, it's the debut album.
It was, you know, back in the day in those late 60s, they would do singles and all that kind of stuff, and then sometimes they would just put all that some of that stuff together as an album. Their first album reminded me of. You know what I mean? Because the Beatles did that when they first came out. There was like different tracks that were on different albums in England on the real album. They just made different versions of it here. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too because I think on this record they only had 4 original tracks. And then the balance were covers.
Hmm. Yeah, you're right. They did like Hush. Hey Joe, and they did a Beatles song. And
Hush is actually a cover because it was originally written by somebody else, and it was one of the covers that Purple included in that record. What's funny is that nobody thinks of Billy Joe Royal when they hear that song. Everybody thinks of Purple. At least I do.
Yeah, there's a lot of songs that are out there that the covers of bands do are more well-known than the actual original song. And you just think about that band, not the original version of them. Yeah. This is definitely one of them.
Well, they did a lot of covers back then.
Yes, sir.
All Along the Watchtower by Jimi Hendrix is another one. Think about Bob Dylan,
right?
Yeah.
That's very, very true. All right, so let's move on, guys. We're going to play all kinds of different metal tonight with, like I said, something to do with keys involved, be it, a Hammond, be it, like, you know more about the technical, all these different, because you play, don't you, Mr. Maurice? I don't.
So I dabble. I should say Jan in Blues Funeral is the really gifted keyboardist. There's a story where we had just started playing together in Sanctus Bellum before Blues Funeral, and I had only ever known him as a guitar player. So he tells us all that he actually bought a giant organ off of Craigslist and asked me to come to his house and help him move it. And the thing was heavier than all get out. I mean, this was a huge organ. So we get it into his living room, and then that Christmas – he tells everybody that he wants to basically have Sanctus Bellum play his living room for a New Year's party. And so we're like, okay, yeah, cool, we'll do that. So we all get together, we're jamming, and then as soon as we get in there, he's like, yeah, so I'm gonna play all of my solos for this next song on organ. And I thought, okay, maybe he's just had a little bit too much to drink. And then he did it. And I was like, wow, I had no idea that you were a gifted, you know, keyboard player in addition to being able to play guitar that well. That was pretty cool.
Very cool. Let's get into some death metal. I saw these guys live around this time when they put out this album. Of course, we're talking about Nocturnus. One of their classic old school albums is The Key. One of the first, I think about it, one of the first heavy use of keys in like sort of modern death metal style. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Year wise, definitely.
Yeah, because that was, what, 1991?
90? The Key, 90, yeah. The only band doing that around that time was Therion in their early death metal stuff.
That's very true. The song I picked tonight is from the, I want to say their sort of comeback album, the 1999 release of A Serial Tomb. I saw them play at Milwaukee Metal Fest on this album. I think I remember this is right in the height of doing MSR, Mainstream Resistance, back in the day. And the record label sent me like a stack of autographed like promo CDs of this album. And like, we were giving them away like crazy, like candy, basically. So this is Nocturnus. The song is called Apostle of Evil from the album A Serial Tomb. We'll be right back.
I will tell. I am
Welcome back to MSRcast 237. We're talking about synth heavy metal. And that was, well, obviously everyone knows who that was. That was Swallow the Sun, classic track off of Hope. Don't Fall Asleep, which is Horror Part 2.
That's right.
Equally as awesome as Horror Part 1, I think. But yeah, heavy synth lines to start out.
Yeah.
And kind of an unforgettable melody that is kind of almost half delivered by the synth line itself.
I think this is probably in my top five tracks from Swallow the Sun. This is one of my favorite tracks.
Yeah. I mean, the Hope album is probably one of my favorites in their catalog. The stuff they've been putting out lately, though, has been absolutely fantastic. Last year's record, When a Shadow is Forced into Light, I think
is
one of the best things they've ever done. But
I agree.
This track in particular, when I think of Swallow the Sun, instantly the song that plays in my head is this song.
Me too, man. It's, if you want to say it's their standout hit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's the song that sort of epitomizes the band to me. Because it has every element that I'm looking for in a Swallow the Sun song. And it's all right there. Yeah. Easily digestible.
Yeah. I mean, I think it could. Their vibe is summarized in like the first stanza of that song. Don't fall asleep to the weeping of the birds. Don't fall asleep in this room of the fallen. It's just saturated in dejection, mourning, and loss.
Right. I'm called Hope.
And the synth really like brings that crushing, pervasive atmosphere in there too. That sort of, you know, blanket of melancholy in the whole thing. That's all the synth line, basically.
Oh, yeah. So there's some melodic death metal for you, some mellow death, but doom. More on the doom spectrum. What was before Swallow the Sun, my friend? What did you pick?
Yeah, so when we were talking about this episode, one of the first things that came to mind for me was Faith No More, because they were one of the first bands I remember getting into who had a keyboard player who was playing synth lines and not just like kind of adding piano to the thing. Like,
they had a full-time keyboard player.
Yeah, Roddy Bottom.
Yeah, and, I mean, sometimes bands, are, you know, in that ilk or that genre, they would, you know, it would be pre-recorded or something, but no, this was like a full-fledged member of the band. I loved it.
Yeah, and his playing, his melody lines on the keyboard were so integral to those songs that if you remove them from them, it's not complete. Like, you know, a lot of times in Faith No More, the guitar is just there for almost like a rhythmic effect, and the melody is actually being played on the synth and on the keyboard. So I think he's, like, especially in Angel Dust, really crucial to that band's sound.
This is it's a very underrated album, in my opinion, too.
Yeah, I think it's gotten properly, in retrospect, it's gotten the credit it deserves. But yeah, it was definitely overlooked when it came out.
I was just playing, like I think I mentioned earlier, I was playing Rock Band 4. I pulled that back out during this time, and I was playing like Opus and just finding all the heavy stuff that I had. And I was like, oh, Face No More, Midlife Crisis came up. I'm like, this is a really good track. And the minute it started playing, I'm like, oh yeah, we need to play Face No More on this episode.
Yeah, I was going to play Midlife Crisis, but Smaller and Smaller has a more pronounced synth line.
Mm-hmm.
Really pervasive in the song. It's also a super heavy song. And so, yeah, I don't know. This entire album's perfect, honestly.
Yeah, it's interesting. This record was what, early 90? This was 92, right?
92, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I feel like, you know, especially because of Mike Patton's involvement and whatever, Faith No More definitely gets discussed in a metal context, but there's a lot of sort of alternative elements as well that are non-metal traditionally, which is interesting.
I always thought of Faith No More being the non-metal metal band, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because they were definitely able to, you know, reach the masses with their music, and their music is sometimes not, like I said for something else earlier, not easily digestible. It, they definitely had songs that were like epic and their cover of Easing and that kind of stuff. But it's one of those bands where people go by, oh yeah, I love that song Epic on the radio. That's great. And they listen to the rest of the album. I'm like, what is going on here? That's what I loved about them. I think they were way ahead of their time. Anything Mike Patton works on is definitely way ahead of its time. People aren't ready for it.
I feel like this was the last album where you could actually maybe call them a metal band too, because once Jim Martin left, I feel like the metallic aspect of the band sort of it shifted into something else. Like on King for a Day, it was a little more, I think, in line with like alternative hard rock, or I don't know what we would call like punk rock and edge to the guitars. Like Jim Martin really was that anchor to metal that they had. And once he left it, he took it with him.
I can see your point there for sure. I saw him. He was jamming with Infectious Grooves last year, a couple years ago. Did you see that like big event they did? Like one of the main festivals or something. It was like Jim Martin was like on guitar. It was pretty cool.
Huh. No, the only thing I hear about him is that he's like a pumpkin farmer or something these days. So
he did not look the same. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't imagine.
Very cool. So before everything, we started off with Nocturnus, Apostle of Evil from Ethereal Tomb. And we're going to get into some more death metal right here, right? One of my favorite bands.
Oh, yeah, Bloodbath.
Yeah. So, Maurice, why did you pick this particular track?
Well, I love Bloodbath.
I do, too.
I think the first time that I actually came in contact with Bloodbath was an old issue of Brave Words and Bloody Knuckles. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever read that magazine when it was like actually still in print circulating. And they always
what
used
do you
to
mean?
Include
what is, a magazine? What is that?
Yeah, I know, right? But they always used to include in every issue like a sampler disc,
right? Of remember that
various tracks. And the cover of this particular magazine had Opeth on it, so completely unshockingly, I bought it. And then as I started digging into the sampler CD, I'm like, okay, so here's this band, Bloodbath. What's this about? And it was a track, I think it was Like Fire off of Resurrection Through Carnage that was on the disc. So I realized like, okay, Michael's a part of this as well. So are several of the guys from Catatonia, and started digging into, at that point, their limited back catalog, which was the Ominous Blood Vomit EP that this is off of. And this track in particular to me is so cool because it starts off as like your quintessential death metal song. Yep. By just grinding mid-paced death metal the way that you've always expected Sweden to serve it up. And then somewhere in the middle of the song, it just kind of stops and this ether settles over the mix as you hear this like John Carpenter-esque synth pad kick in with like slow chordal accompaniment and Mike's gurgling voice just screaming Furnace Funeral before they come right back into like raging death metal. It's just like the craziest, most memorable moment on a death metal track like that for me.
So I got to ask you, what is your favorite Bloodbath album?
That's a tough question.
That I asked the tough questions here.
Mine is
Nightmares Made Flesh.
Yeah. Nightmares is such a great record, and I think Peter did an incredible job having to come into a band where, I mean, Mike had really established himself as the vocalist. For me, it's probably a toss-up between either Fathomless Mastery or Resurrection, and I'll probably give the edge to Resurrection just purely over nostalgia for the most part. Sure. And the fact that I don't think there is a more evil song than Cry My Name. That song is just so – it's just dripping with evil.
I have favorite songs from each of their albums, but I think overall it's Fathomless Mastery. It's just – it's – like I said, it's a master recording. Everything about that album is just phenomenal. And, I mean, when you have this caliber of talent in this band, I mean – you have Michael, you have Peter Tacturin, you have Nick Holmes now. I mean, it's They need to all do like what Helloween did and all go on tour together. Do the three lineup singer tour. I'd pay for that.
Amazing. Yeah, kind of like what Michael Schenker's doing now with like Robin McCauley and Doogie White. We'll just get them all at Grand Bottom. We'll get them all on stage together and rotate them out and then have like some big super group jams towards the end.
I take my fucking money now, as the meme says. I'm down. And hopefully, you know, with everything happening, they had to they were scheduled to do a small little tour around what show were they playing? Was it the
Maryland Death Fest?
It was Maryland Death Fest, right. And I thought they were gonna do like LA and New York and some stuff like that, but I don't know, it's a band I've always wanted to see, and we tried to pick a band to go see live every year. Maybe next year. I don't know.
I had tickets to Maryland Death Fest at the end of next month, so I'm pretty bummed because these guys were on the bill, Dismember, Necrophobic. So when you talk about some of the big Swedish heavy hitters in death metal, this was going to be my year.
Yeah, unfortunately, Maryland Death Fest always falls around the same time as my main work event, so I can't go anywhere. I can't go. Yeah. I've never been. Have you ever been?
No, this was going to be my first year going too.
You know, you've gone. What is the biggest metal fest type of show you've been to? I know we're going off topic here, but
probably Desert Fest, Belgium, the one that's in Antwerp.
Mm-hmm. Who played that? Was it more doom metal, like stoner stuff?
Yeah, more like doom psych stoner type stuff. Some of the bands that in previous episodes we've covered, like Blues Pills, Person. Electric Wizard played that. Just kind of a broad swath of bands like that. Yob played it. Cadaver. Mm. Yob's set was incredible at Desert Fest. That was actually really, really cool. Color Haze.
What about you, Sean? I don't know if we've ever discussed this. What's the biggest festival style show you've ever been to?
Festival style show?
Yeah.
Was probably Hell's Heroes last year.
Okay.
Yeah, festival style.
That would have been happening this weekend?
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago? Was it? Yeah, the 18th, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That's another one that's like, I was really looking forward to that. Candlemass as the headliner.
Yeah, that crushed me.
Yeah, I was like, no!
It's all going to, hopefully next year, everything can get back to normal and we can see live bands again.
Yeah.
I don't know. If they started doing bands right now, like June, July, August, would you go to a concert?
Yes.
That was pretty quick.
Absolutely.
I think it probably depends. I mean, if it was like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of who would be. If it was like the Devin Townsend show that we saw at Warehouse, which was probably the last show that I saw before.
That was definitely the last show that I saw.
Everything started going crazy with the pandemic, etc. Because
that was the same week.
Yeah.
It was like on Monday and everything like hit the fan like 2 days later.
Yeah, he was sick on that tour as well and was still kind of pressing on. And then it wasn't just but a few days later that he announced he was canceling the balance of the tour. So we got lucky.
We really
did. That was a pretty reasonably full house. I don't think I would go to a show that's necessarily quite that packed, but if it was more of a local gig at like a Rudyard's or something where you can kind of space out a little bit and it's not going to be 600 people stacked, then probably.
Have you been watching any of his live quarantine shows?
I did see, I think he posted it maybe a couple days ago, a little quarantine show. That was cool.
We've been watching him live, and you know it's like $20 for a ticket, and it all goes to different hospitals and things like that. So it's worth it. The one last weekend was a little off; like the audio was off, maybe like by 4 or 5 seconds the whole time. But dude, I don't know what this guy does. He fixed the audio, the syncing problem, and he had it up on YouTube like an hour later. So we rewatched it. It was like the correct syncing. You know what I mean? It's pretty cool. Go Devin.
Yeah, he's impressive.
Did you notice the cameras that he had?
I saw the one that he had on his fan that was pivoting back and forth, which I thought was hilarious.
So, yes, my wife loved that, the fan cam. So he basically he gutted like a box top or like an oscillating fan, took everything out but the motor and the activators and all that, and put an iPhone in there, taped an iPhone into it. So it was a moving camera. And you know the one that was called, he called the headbanging cam? You know what that was?
What?
It was a stand mixer.
Nice.
It was like a stand mixer, and he had like some contraption attached to it. It was pretty crazy. Dude's a genius. I'm sorry. He's just amazing. And he got a kick out of that, the fan cam. Every time he would just turn and look at it and just smile at it.
He's a really interesting cat, man. Devin's the kind of guy who like is so brilliant that sometimes he writes songs or albums that are so spot on, you just don't know what to do with yourself.
Yep.
And then sometimes I think he's just so overwhelmed by his creative thought process that he just, for me, he goes a little bit too far into experimentalville. And then I'm like, I don't know if I can reside in the same space as this right now. I certainly appreciate it. I dig it, but you've gone a bit too far for me.
Are you talking about Empath?
Empath definitely, like, that's the hard part for me. Empath is so brilliantly recorded and there's so many awesome moments on that record, but then there's also certain parts where I'm just like,
it took me a long time to really find my way with that release. We talked about like our top albums last year, and I don't think it even cracked my top 10, did it, Sean?
I don't think so.
And now I can't get enough of it. I go back and listen to it all the time. It's just one of those weird sayings, you know what I mean? I think after seeing some of that stuff live again, it sort of, you know, opened it up a little bit more. Like, I wasn't a big fan of the song Why, but I love that song now.
And it's interesting. I mean, I think his live interpretations of certain things carry a lot more heft and weight than they do on the recorded versions. Mm-hmm. The last couple times that I've seen him do Deadhead live, for instance, like that song's probably my favorite Devin Townsend song. So I'm a little bit biased, but every time that I've heard it live, like I don't even know how to describe it. Like, he's so present in what he's doing and it comes through the music so hard. Way more than you hear on the studio version.
Very true. All right, let's move off of our segues here and get back into the music. Let's get into Bloodbath. This is Furnace Funeral, and we'll be right back.
Woke up transformation in the furnace of fate. Almost on my body, I know it's far too late. Air is removed by the Empress, yes. With all the people left, well, there's life in the bliss. Eyes leave the sockets, so it takes the bliss. Herbs are spoiling, burst and gush. Feel the roll. Feel the roll. Open up his guns, complaining of his first. Speedy and rare for the course is a must. See the precious smiles, when we devour by the freezer. Genitals shut up in the price of being mean. Last over, don't be mean with spice. Roasted body, blood is my demise. The center of the table, the sound of flux. Turn as the frequency in the EX. As your men spoil, they don't seem to care. As the flesh comes in the air.
Welcome back to the show, my friends. That is a little Demiurgia, Dinty Burger, as we like to call them. We wanted something that definitely epitomizes what we're talking about here. Those heavy scents in this song, Morning Palace, phenomenal.
Yeah, and iconic, too.
Definitely iconic.
Just the intro to that is like, to me, it brings me back to like the late 90s and discovering symphonic black metal. And weirdly, I mean, I got into Demiurge and all those bands, Emperor, at the same time, but Demiurge was the hook that pulled me in.
Yeah.
And Enthroned Darkness Triumphant was that first album that I really got into. And then I really, disciplined myself to like, okay, try to get into Emperor. You've bought the album, so try to get into it. And, and it slowly, I was able to crack those too. But for me, Enthroned Darkness Triumphant is kind of like the iconic synth, placement of synth into symphonic black metal that made it symphonic black metal. And I know Cradle was doing it beforehand too, so.
Yeah, very true, but yeah, we didn't pick Cradle for any of these episodes, but I think Demiurgia, they are just the masters of blending this style together. I think the haunting, keys and then the disharmonic shit they're doing, it's,
yeah, definitely. And I know it's like unpopular to enjoy their music these day and age.
No, because why is it unpopular?
Because of the commercial success they've enjoyed.
Well, that's why I don't like Metallica, but we're not going there right now.
I don't like Metallica because they refuse to release good records, but you're right, we're not going there.
And they suck, but, admit it, they've always sucked. We just didn't admit it back in the day.
I mean, I can't go that far. Everything, at least through Master of Puppets, is super good. No, Injustice for All, even. I guess that came out from Master. But the black album was a turning point.
Very, very true. All right, so we're getting off Metallica. We're going back to Demiurgia and Emperor. What was the first Demiurge stuff that you guys heard? Was it this album?
This album, yeah.
Okay. I think so, me too.
I bought it based, I remember reading the name in Metal Maniacs, and I used to have a list of that I would keep in my pocket in my wallet.
Dude, I did too.
Yeah, and so I was at, I don't know what music store I was at, and I saw it, and that was the only CD they had by them, and I just, bought it blind, and that's how I pretty much bought most of that stuff back then. Didn't hear anything beforehand, just bought it blind.
Me too. Metal Maniacs back. I'm glad you brought that up. Metal Maniacs back in the day, man. I would do the same exact thing. I would read through each issue and then write down band names that looked interesting, or here's a review of a band, and I would just go buy the shit off their recommendation. That's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
I miss that magazine so much.
I remember those little promo discs on the, you were mentioning the Brave Words and Bloody Knuckles, the discs.
Uh-huh.
I remember getting those when I would go buy the magazine at Superstand, and they would, I think I got into the Crown that way. I got into so many bands through those discs.
Oh yeah. Same. And yeah, Metal Maniacs was such a great publication too. There was just so many obscure bands. I want to say it was through Metal Maniacs that they were still doing a lot of tape trading, particularly with like underground black metal bands, where it was just sort of like, write us a letter and we'll send you our demo kind of thing. And I ended up getting some sort of a demo from a band from like the Midwest. I think they were from Minnesota or something. They sent me their tape, and the guy in his letter back was like, oh yeah, dude, if you're getting into this kind of stuff, you should listen to Hellhammer and Celtic Frost and all this other stuff. So it's just really cool how there was still a lot of underground awareness burgeoning through publications like that.
Back before the internet, guys, this is what we had to do. Tape trading, and we definitely, it was the different age back then. I'm older than you guys, so I remember not even having the internet. Remember having to log on to AOL and getting like that you know, the 2400 baud modem. It was great. All right. So before we had Dimmu Borgir, we had a very I like this song a lot. This is Judas Priest, my friends.
Oh yeah.
The 80s version of Judas Priest. Let's talk about this, Sean. You picked this one.
Yeah, I mean, so the Turbo album, you know, for years I sort of just disregarded it and stuff. About 2 years ago, I started listening to it again, just because I always loved Out in the Cold. That was like the one song I would always go back to. But I started listening to the entire album again, and that entire album, the way they incorporated synth into the songwriting and almost gave the entire every song on the album this sort of like super texturized, robotic, almost like the sound of machinery fitting together like at a factory or something. And it really is epitomized in this song, because it's like, it's just this weird kind of relic from the 80s that sounds like futuristic and dated at the same time. So it's at once like a really good example of how to use synth and a really bad example. But I still think the album overall is really good. Great songs. It got unfairly bashed. And I think if you want to go back and listen to it as research into like how to incorporate synth to make your song sound, you know, kind of quasi futuristic, it's a good place to start.
What do you think it was about that time period, that, you know, 84 to, you know, 88-ish era, for a lot of these metal bands that were really starting to experiment, especially bands that started in the 70s, you know, like Rush and Queen and Judas Priest and things like that, and they did these almost full synth-heavy albums. What do you think? Were they trying to...
Well, in Queensryche, too, with Rage for Order.
Yeah, know? That's true.
I just think it was like a new toy that they had, and they were going for it, yeah.
I watched that Rush documentary recently on Netflix, and they, you know, they always had keys and stuff, and that kind of stuff, but Geddy Lee is like, yeah, they convinced me that I went a little too far with some of that heavy synth stuff back in the day, and they, like, pulled off on all of that. Speaking of the song, have you ever heard the Witherscape cover of this song?
Yes.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Fantastic.
Dan Swano can do no wrong. That's all I'm going to say.
Kerry, going back to your question, though, I think, too, yeah, it's because 81 to 85, I mean, synth was dominating a lot of commercially selling music at the time.
That's so true. Anything, so yeah.
You've pop got music, like Duran, pop Duran, music, Duran, yeah. Yeah, Duran Duran, Soft Cell, Depeche Mode, Kraftwerk, like a bunch of these different types of bands, Tears for Fears. I was actually just watching this show. I don't know if it's like Showtime or Stars. It's called Black Monday, about the Wall Street crash, okay, set in the 80s. And at the beginning of one of the episodes, Shout by Tears for Fears plays. And you just hear that and you're like, yeah, this sounds like the 80s.
Yes.
You know, like, it just. So I think with that happening, especially bands that had achieved some commercial success at that time, even though they're metal, mm-hmm, and there's certain things you have to do to be metal, I think, and remain metal, we're probably looking at that and being like, well, hey, like, this is a thing that is selling records right now. Maybe we should give it a shot.
I don't know. Looking for a piece of that action.
Yeah.
I don't think Rush did it for that reason, but I think they might have done it for just experimental reasons. A lot of bands, I think, in the genre, in metal, we're looking to just experiment, and this was the new big thing, you know. This is, you know, it was all over the fucking radio waves. I love 80s music much more than I should, but I grew up in that time, you know what I mean?
No, totally. And I was meaning more Priest than, say, Rush.
Okay. All right, I can see that. But because Priest didn't do it very long. It's the only album I can really think of that was sort of permeated with this. Can you think of anything else?
I mean, they had like vestiges of it on Ram It Down, but yeah, I mean, this is pretty much, this is why it's such a fascinating album, because it's like such a one-off in metal history. I mean, not even Seven Son of a Seven Son had this much of a synth heavy drapery over it, you know?
Seven Son was very, they had a lot of heavy synth when I think we're going to get to that, but it was still more in the background compared to some of the other musical instruments on the album. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was definitely a departure.
Rage for Order is the only other album I can think of in terms of like this, like the more traditional vein of metal where they really went for it with a synth on those songs. Like it's all over the place on that album. Some of it's really tied into the concept of the album about the future and dystopia and stuff like that. So maybe that had something to do with it.
It worked for them though. I mean, and they always, and Queensryche kept elements of that through a lot of their albums too. So,
oh yeah. All the way into Mindcrime and Empire.
Yeah. Empire for sure. Yeah. That was
definitely.
All right. So, before Judas Priest, we had, of course, Bloodbath. We have another band coming up. This is a local band. How do you say this name? Can you help me here?
Is that Boo's Funeral?
I think so. Boo? Is that a booze? That might be saying a little too much now, but yeah.
That is an unofficial nickname I feel that they've given us.
Is it really?
Yeah.
That's funny. Let's talk about, we've had you on the show before. We've talked about your bands. But we definitely had to include Blues Funeral because you mentioned Jan before. He is a keyboard master, man. He has that Hammond. It's so awesome. And your music is dripping with this stuff. It's just a love letter to like late 70s, you know, like Deep Purple, in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely. And the track that we're going to listen to, I think, is one that really showcases that too. We use in the band, we use a keyboard. It's called a Nord Electro. And the thing that's awesome about this, I think it's Swedish made. So it has a lot of different onboard effects and emulators. But the biggest thing that we were using it for, especially on this record, was the fact that it does a fairly decent job of emulating a Hammond B3 organ, like you mentioned, and even goes as far as to have like an onboard Leslie, like roto vibe effect that you can key in. And if you use foot switches, you can actually cause the speed of the rotating speaker that's being emulated to accelerate or decelerate to get some of the kinds of tones that you would hear from, you know, from like a band like Deep Purple and John Lord in particular. So definitely enjoy this song. I'm biased because I wrote it, but Jan's keyboard work on this really took it to the next level. And so I'm definitely grateful to him for that.
Now, before we move on, I don't know how much you want to talk about this, but you do have another band that you're working on right now. No keyboards at all, right?
None yet. We'll see. Maybe I'll find a way to rip off that Bloodbath song to put it in there. But yeah, so a few of us in a couple of different bands here in Houston got together, and we've started a project now called Hazarot that definitely is an ode to bands like Bloodbath, Entombed, Dismember, some of those early sort of Swedish death metal bands, definitely centered around kind of a mid-paced, you know, 120 beats per minute kind of vibe.
Who's in it? Who can you say anything yet?
Yeah, no, the cat's out of the bag.
Oh, okay, great.
We officially announced it on Facebook, so it's out there. Brandon Johnson from Doomstress, he and I have been talking about this project for years, so we finally got to a point where we've started to be able to work some things out, and we talked about some other peoples to bring into the mix. Brought in Ben Yeager from Sanctus Bellum for bass, Kryptos from Spectral Manifest for drums, Josh Merritt.
Papa Josh, he was a founding member of this very here podcast.
Oh, badass. Yeah. I actually didn't know that about Josh. Yeah. That's awesome. But so Papa Josh is going to be doing drums for us on this. And then Justin McKittrick from Scroll Keeper will be doing vocals.
That's awesome. That's very cool.
Pretty stoked about it. So we've been kind of toiling in anonymity for a little bit and have some things put together, some good solid foundations for some stuff to come. So
I've heard some stuff. It's pretty fucking killer. And you can go to, you're on Facebook or you are?
Yes, we are.
It's Haserot, Haserot. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, I think the backslash on Facebook is Haserot HTX.
Very cool. Check it out. We'll put a link here in the episode notes on our website too, so you can check that out. And as soon as the album's ready to go, we'll definitely play some and have you back on. We'll talk about it.
That'd be awesome, man. Love to.
So can you, this is the first time you might have done this on a podcast for a while. Can you introduce your own song for us?
Yes, this is Shadow of the Snake off of the album Awakening by Blues Funeral.
Welcome back to the show, and
thank you. I appreciate it every time you say that to me.
You should know that I was actually just listening to San Sebastian yesterday. I went for a drive because I hadn't been out of the house in like 4 days, and I was going crazy.
Oh yeah,
and it's part of I made this anti-anxiety power metal playlist, and it's one of the tracks on there. And I was going down a toll road at like 70 miles an hour or whatever. And I had this blaring, and it felt great. And it was like the kind of tonic I needed to lift me up a little bit yesterday. So heavy, heavy synth-laden band.
Yeah.
Keyboards, a lot of the keyboards and the synths are basically the drivers of the melody alongside Tony Kakko. And more so than Stradivarius, I think Sonata Arctica was really drenched in using synth as a primary instrument.
I mean, you said Stradivarius. That's definitely one of the bands that, when we talk about this, it pops into my mind like immediately. But yeah, the early Sonata stuff definitely too. Not anything recent, because you know nobody can get through one of those albums. But
yeah, I mean they're still using synth though.
They are
just not very well.
Yeah, we're not going to go there. We've talked about that at length before.
Yeah. This is from the second album. I mean, their first four albums, I think, are amazing. If you want that kind of sugar high, the power metal rush.
Who doesn't want that sometimes?
Yeah, you need it right now.
Yes, you do. And before Sonata Arctica, we had a little bit more Mellow Death. This is Morris Principium Est. Very catchy song. This is, they definitely, what I like about some of these bands, especially like Moors and, you know, Omnium Gatherum and that kind of stuff, is the heavy synth keyboard stuff is actually part of the songwriting process. It's part of the music. It's not thrown in as an afterthought or anything like that. It's just as important to the melody of the song as the guitar riffing is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. This was another band that I seem to recall first encountering probably back in the early 2000s after Inhumanity came out on another Brave Words and Bloody Knuckles sampler disc.
Oh, really? Back that for you? Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. Man. The name definitely like spoke to me. Death is the beginning.
Yeah.
I can't remember. I can't remember when I got into them. I don't know. I think it was probably later than that because I don't remember ever buying like one of their CDs early on in that era. So it was long before Embers of a Dying World, I think.
Yeah, I'll admit I was really late on this train. I probably didn't get into them probably until like 2014. I think it was Dawn of the Fifth Era, the first real album I heard. Then I really dived back into their entirety. So do you guys know their new guitar player, the guy they found off YouTube, Andy Gillian? Have you watched his stuff on YouTube? Maurice.
Yeah, the guy's he's great. Yeah. He's
amazing. He got to start doing like 8-bit like video game covers and stuff like that. But if you go to his page on his YouTube page, he does these when they toured a couple years ago with Wolfheart and was it Enoch? Which band was it? I can't remember which band they toured with.
Carrick Angren.
Yeah, that's who it was.
Yeah.
They did this tour diary that are fucking hilarious, man. The singer Ville, there's a inside joke on these episodes that's moping around the world with Ville. He's always sad or depressed about something. Oh, you've got to watch them, man. They're so funny.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah. And like my wife, she has like a sound bite she got from it. It's just so well done, and it's a lot of fun. And he goes to like NAMM and that kind of stuff, and you know does video vlogs and things like that, which is cool to see a vlogger in the metal spectrum doing things like that because you don't really see a lot of that.
Yeah,
so very cool. And this band before was called Blues Funeral.
Sounds about right.
Are you guys working on anything new right now?
So the third record has been done for a little bit. We're in the process of getting artwork finished up, and then the hope is to, at some point, get it out on wax and have a vinyl release for the third record.
Very cool. Vinyl would be really cool.
That's the goal. We shall see.
All right. So let's get into the next thing here, and this is a band called Haken. I wanted to play something very proggy. I was thinking about Dream Theater. I was thinking about all these different bands that popped into my mind. But after seeing this band opening up for Devin Townsend last month or the 2 months ago, I lost track of time already, whenever it was, I really wanted to really focus on these guys. They're a really great band, and they even Devin Townsend used their keyboardist when he was playing live, so he just did double duty. This is the song Puzzle Box. I think it has a lot of cool guitar and keyboard back and forth, so they're sort of playing against each other a lot. And this is from the 2018 album called Vector. Were you a fan of these guys before you saw them live, or Maurice?
So I can't remember where I read about these guys first, but I want to say it might have actually been with the release of Vector that I first became aware of them, just through like reviews of records that were coming out in 18. There's a lot about them that I enjoy, but especially live, the vocals for me are a little bit more of an acquired taste. Mm-hmm. I think this is probably one of the better songs that they have, but from that live experience, and I don't know, part of it, I always sometimes tend to blame the venue for the way things...
Especially that venue. That venue is not the best.
There's something about that room that's just so challenging to get the mix right in for metal.
Unless you bring in your own sound guy with you.
Yeah. Well, what's funny about that, too, is I remember a year that Opeth and Flames were touring together, and they played that venue, and...
I think I remember that show.
Came in towards the tail end of In Flames' set, which was by design.
I was about to say, that's a good time to come in on it.
And it just sounded like mud.
Yeah.
And I know that's not the band, because they, in spite of what I may think of their music these days, I mean, they have competent sound.
Yeah.
And Opeth got on the stage, and their engineer took the reins, and instantly the sound cleaned up and got a lot better. So I was pretty amused by that.
Yeah, I've seen Symphony X and Overkill one time there at that location. And I've seen a lot of shows there, but that particular show, it was just a fucking wall of sound. You know what was going on. It was just unfortunate.
The worst that I think I can remember was seeing Wu-Tang, Rotting Christ, and I forget who else was on the bill, but particularly for Rotting Christ set, and that band is a very guitar-dominant band, at least that's critical to their sound, all you could hear was vocals and thundering double bass and nothing else.
Wow.
Yeah, I was at that show. Wasn't that the Mayhem show?
Yes, that's who else was on the bill.
And Mayhem sounded so terrible.
Wu-Tang sounded passable, but having seen them multiple times, it was not their best sound.
Yeah.
And everybody else, I mean, having seen both bands in other venues before as well, I'm like, man, nobody's getting their due right now. This is not ideal.
Wow. We're talking about, I guess we could say the name of the show, of the club.
Of the venue, yeah.
Yeah, Warehouse Live. I've seen shows in the small room, too, that sound pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, the crazy thing is I've seen a lot of good shows at that venue, and I have seen some shows in the big room that sound great. I mean, Devin, I thought, actually sounded really good. Overkill and Exhorter, I thought, sounded great.
That was the Friday before.
Yeah.
That was at that show. Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. You never know what you're going to get at that location. And I'm sure there's venues all around the country that are like that, too, people complain about. But if that's where the bands are playing, that's where you got to go. You know what I mean?
I mean, I have nothing against the venue. I think it's a great venue. It's a lovely space. I like that it's pretty close and in a good area. But
yeah.
There's something about the big room that I think is challenging.
I like that it's walking distance from my office. I can park at work and just walk over to a show, which I do all the time.
Makes it convenient, right?
Yeah, really does. Literally, it's like half a mile from my desk. I can walk there. It's pretty cool.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's a cool spot. I mean, I've definitely seen a lot of great and memorable shows there. And like I said, there's a lot of times where the sound comes out and it's fantastic, but there's definitely a lot of situations. And I think in more cases than not, it's for extreme metal bands that do have pretty pronounced and fast and prominent double bass, where it tends to eclipse everything else in the mix.
I get that. Yeah, I think one of the shows I saw before with Morbid Angel there, it was the same thing. It was just like thunderous double bass. That's all you could really hear, you know?
Yeah.
All right, going back to Hiking real quick. I heard what you said about the vocals. Sometimes I guess it's an acquired taste for this band. Cockroach King, that's the song that got me hooked on this band. And when I told that to my Metal Geeks co-host Dave at the show, I'm like, wait till you hear the song, it's going to change your mind about the band. And he leaned over to me afterwards, he's like, you were fucking right. He's like, that song is stuck in my head. Because he wasn't sure what to think about him or when they first came on too, you know. Because I don't think a lot of people were expecting a full-on prog band like that to be playing in front of Devin. It was just, people are just like, okay, what's going on? But they're really nice guys. If you like what you hear here, go listen to some more in that. Let's get into, this is from the 2018 album Vector, Puzzle Box. Check it out.
Unable to solve this puzzle, borrow my ways to win. Seven holy paths to hell and your trip begins. Seven downward slopes, seven bloodied hopes, seven are your burning fires, seven your desires. Yeah.
I shouldn't have to tell the listeners what that song was.
We should just ignore.
I'm not going to insult anyone's intelligence.
Who was it? What band was that? Never heard that band before.
So, greatest metal album of all time, in my opinion, Seven Son of a Seven Son.
Is that so? That's your favorite Iron Maiden album of all time?
It's not only my favorite Iron Maiden album. To me, it's my favorite metal album of all time.
Wow!
Oh, wow!
So, yeah. I mean, what more can I say about it? I guess.
I think I mean, you like
you
got, it.
You know, when you read the history, though, the reason why I think it deserves to be on this episode is in the official Iron Maiden biography, Steve Harris was very baffled at the time of why it got a lot of negative reaction in America. And I think, you know, we were playing Turbo earlier, mm-hmm. or Out in the Cold from Turbo. I think a lot of that backlash on Priest spilled over onto this. That if anyone heard anything like keyboard related, they thought that it was wimpy, and it was just like a feeling of that era of like keep keyboards out of metal and stuff like that. So I think that Maiden got a little bit of it on this album, but not as much because these songs are awesome, and I think fans quickly realized these songs are awesome.
I think it works, but I think it works in a really good way on this album. I don't understand. I don't really remember all the criticism about this album, but I've gone back and realized that there was. I'm like, why? I don't get it.
Yeah, I think Steve Harris said that he was baffled by people in America calling it a really European-sounding album, which he took to mean criticism of the keyboard elements. But, you know, who knows?
And why Moonchild?
Probably because I mean it's so encompassing of all the little effects they're doing all throughout this album. You could easily put the title track on here for, you know, the dramatics that it, you know, that the band engages in, but with the kind of grandeur of that song. But I think Moonchild is pretty representative of that balance between like Can I Play With Madness and then the title track.
Now, what do you think about this, Maurice? Do you agree?
So I think there's a lot to say about this record. First of all, I agree with Sean, at least in that this is probably one of, if not my favorite Maiden album. The song Moonchild in particular, I mean, I think it's such a strong album opener. And I'm thinking back, I don't know if you guys were there. I want to say this is 2012 at Cynthia Woods when they basically were going through and doing the Seventh Son tour.
Yep.
Yeah.
I was there.
And when Maiden gets on stage and everything's black and you just see everybody, you know, with their cigarette lighters or whatever's going on in the darkness, and you hear the synth kick in at the beginning of Moonchild, right after Bruce has the whole little like seven deadly sins, you know, seven ways to hell kind of intro. It was just like such an intense moment. And then the guitar comes in. I mean, it just like sets the tone for something that's really heavy and grandiose that's about to get into gear. I love that song.
That was a great tour. You reminded me about it. I forgot about that. Who was on that tour with them? Do you remember?
Coheed and Cambria.
Yeah, that's right.
Was it that was a show I took my that's the show I took my niece to. That was one of her very first metal shows ever. And she was really into Coheed and Cambria. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, they're okay.
Yeah.
My wife really likes them, so unfortunately I've seen them more times than I'd care to admit. But
happy wife, happy life.
Yeah, that was the first time that I had seen any part of them. We tried to strategically arrive just in time to miss their set, but I think caught one of their songs or something while we were...
They're not in flames. You can't do that.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, yeah. I mean... Iron Maiden, classic album. I don't know if it's in my top, my favorite album by them, but it's definitely in my top five for sure.
I mean, The Evil That Men Do, The Clairvoyant, yeah. The title track.
Yeah, there's not a bad song on the album. The Evil That Men Do, I can't play that when I drive, I've realized, because I'll just like find myself like 20 miles over the speed limit. It's kind of dangerous.
Living on the razor's edge, balancing on a ledge, Sean.
Yeah. That's right. Doing that evil that men do.
white knuckling, just barreling down 59, living on Razor's Edge.
Yeah, remind me when you listen to that song to not get on the freeway with you.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Seventh Son is definitely a record, and that song in particular, where I need it for the opposite reasons. Like, if I've just gone on a road trip to Austin or something and need to drive back to Houston and need some steam, then Maiden's coming on the playlist if it's a night drive, for sure.
Yeah. All righty. Very cool. What else can we say about Iron Maiden? They are the masters of metal.
Would have to agree.
Let's talk about Arcturus. Do you want to talk about them, Maurice?
I love Arcturus. And this record in particular, Sideshow Symphonies, with the former bass player of Dimmu Borgir doing vocals, also of Borknagar fame.
Yep.
Love Vortex's vocals on this record. And I think the guitar works great. There's this crazy, like, esoteric haze that just sits over the album. And I think a big part of that is keyboard driven.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, this record is just like, it doesn't approach swashbuckling, even though I think the image that it conjures in a way is of like some sort of super psychedelic prog swashbucklers.
Okay.
It's just such a great record.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Borknagar. This is the more synth heavy Borknagar. They've always been that way to me, especially the last three albums. I love Arcturus. They're spacey and super cool. And like you said, Vortex's vocals on this album. I love Vortex. He is one of my favorite vocalists. He's just amazing.
Yeah. I love the opening lyrics to this song too. Probing a voiceless void, searching for a closure. Poison tentacles from the past are tumbling, fumbling closer. It's just, it's that weird Arcturus vibe. It's just so good.
Yeah, and you know, Hibernation Sickness Complete. I mean, you could take that as a Star Wars reference if you wanted to. It's not, but I am. That's how geeky I am. You know, it's about space travel and all that. But no, it's about Star Wars. I think so. And before Arcturus, we had some Hiken, Puzzle Box from the 2018 album Vector. Now, we've played a wide variety of bands throughout this episode, and we have more on the next episode. What do you think makes... I'm trying to think of a good way to ask this. We'll start with you, Maurice. What makes a good keyboard-driven band, no matter what style of music they are? What do you think is that defining factor?
That's a really interesting question, and I think you have to kind of think about it in terms of the purpose of the instrument, which is really true for anything. Anything could be an accompanying instrument, and anything could be a lead instrument. So I think for certain genres of music, particularly things that lean power metal or maybe that have a touch more prog, it's necessary to have a keyboard player with a level of virtuosity that can match, rival, or exceed that of the guitar player. I mean, think of John Lord, right? Like, John Lord does a great job of holding down rhythm, but he can solo with the best of them.
Yeah.
Think about, you know, guys like, there's a band, I want to say it's a Dutch band called Sun Caged. And the only reason that I'm really aware of this band is because their keyboard player, his name is like Joost, J-O-O-S-T Van Broek, I think, played a guest solo on the Human Equation album of Arion.
Are you stealing into my segue here?
I'm not stealing into your segue. I'm bringing it up to drive a point. I don't even think we're listening to the same Arion album. So I think I can go Human Equation and not give away your next point. But I bought the expanded edition of that has the behind the scenes footage on the DVD and all of that when that record came out. And this particular like synth lead line that this guy plays, I mean, it's just, it's masterful. And it's necessary for the vibe of the song, which is a very progressive song. But then, sure, if you think about, you know, bands like, for instance, Dimmu and Morning Palace, which we listened to earlier, the point of the keys is not to necessarily take a lead presence, or with Swallow the Sun, it's not to take a lead presence. Yeah. It's to create like a haze and a sheen
and an atmosphere. Yeah.
That's very potentially unsettling if that's what you're going for, mm-hmm, or ethereal or otherworldly if that's what you're going for in the vibe of the music. So that's my take on it anyway.
What say you, Sean?
Yeah, no, I agree with that, because I think the one fundamental thing is that there has to be a purpose to it. Like, there's so many bands who have a keyboard player who the only reason they're there is to play orchestral samples, mm-hmm, you know, for like some really like third rate symphonic metal band or something. And the best use of keyboards in metal is either when the guy has autonomy to write his own melodies, sure, or he's like the lead songwriter, if they're doing something to add atmosphere and they have their own, you know, unique contribution to that, like in Swallow the Sun or in Borknagar or something. When they're just kind of a prop on stage, that's when it's kind of useless. So
yeah. I think Maurice hit it on the head when he said it's either just two major things, it's virtuosity or it's the atmosphere to the band. And yeah, I think those metal bands have really adapted this instrument into those two yin and yang sort of styles in the music. I love a good virtuosic, you know, keyboard player that can just get down live, you know what I mean? It's funny, Maurice, you mentioned Sun Cage, and you mentioned Juiced Vanderbroek, right? I think that's how you say his name.
I think that's his name.
The last song we're going to play on this episode is from Arion, the new album that just came out, the live album called Electric Castle Live and Other Tales. Juiced is now an integral part of the band Arion, because he's writing and producing the last couple of live productions that they've done.
Oh, wow.
So if you, I was like, you're stealing my segue. If you go watch these live performances, especially this Electric Castle one that just came out like a couple weeks ago, he is definitely an integral part. He's helping put the whole production together with Arjen. And he's basically a second person in the band now, that's besides Arjen. It's an amazing performance. If you haven't seen these live, the Arion Universe and then the Into the Electric Castle, he is everywhere, dude. He has like surrounded by keyboards and like a Nord, and he has like actual, like he just turns around and is playing different styles, and it's amazing, man. I think you'd really, really, really dig it.
I need to check that out. Yeah, I want to say, and it's been a hot minute since I've gone back to that record, but I think it's, because Human Equation is a two CD album, I want to say it's the second track on the first record that has the big synth solo that Juiced did. And I don't know if that was the first time that the two of them collaborated together or not, but it's a very like memorable use of synthesizer where I was like, wow, who is this kid and what band does he play for?
Right. Yeah. There's like an hour and a half documentary of Juiced and Arjen just talking about the production of the whole thing. It's really, really cool. If there's so many great vocalists on this album, they have pretty much the entire band vocal lineup from the first album. I mean, Annika is there, Fish from Aurelian is there, and then after Into the Electric Castle is over, they do songs from various eras in his career. So there's something from, they do a Marillion song. There's a Guilt Machine song. There's something from a solo album. Really cool stuff. And of course, they end with Star One, you know, as they have to. But before we end this episode, well, let's talk about the song real quick. We're going to play The Garden of Emotions, which is one of my favorite songs from this band. But let's talk about where people can find MSRcast all over the internet. Of course, you can find us on Spotify and not iTunes anymore, Apple Music, and all the cool places that you would actually download your podcatchers from. You can search for MSRcast or Metal Geeks. We're on the same feed right there. We're on metalgeekspodcast.com. You can find us on social medias at MSRcast or sister show at Metal Geeks. Now, my friend Sean, where can they find you on the internet?
The Metal Pigeon, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram.
And our special guest here, plug away, man. This is your time to shine. Whatever you want to talk about.
You can find Blues Funeral on Facebook. You can find Hazrod on Facebook. You can find Blues Funeral on Bandcamp. We're out there.
Very cool. Well, thanks for joining us for this episode. We are going to be back on the next one, and there's even more bands filled with keyboard and synth goodness. So thanks again. Here is something from the brand new Arion, Electric Castle Live and Other Tales. Check it out, and we'll see you guys next time. Oh, yeah. What's the last thing we have to say, Sean?
Keep it metal.
Yes. Can you say it for us, sir?
Keep it metal.
The hippie and the Roman had it right. They dried their tears. They conquered their fears. I can't say the same for the night. Look behind you. The bridge is gone. Fate now beckons you on to the Garden of Emotion. But beware the voices in the sky. Flowers can prick, and cars are known to die.
My God.
Listening to another fine podcast brought to you by MSR Productions. All rights reserved, blah, 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 blah. For reviews, archives of our podcasts, and all your other metal geekery needs, please visit metalgeeks.net. Keep it geeky. Keep it metal.